Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents The Dragon King Trilogy, The Warlords of Nin, Part 1. Created by Stephen R. Lawhead. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Thomas Keegan, David Coyne, Dylan Lynch, Joe Brack, Andy Clements, Tim Getman, Lily Beacon, Karen Novak, Elizabeth Jernigan, James Konacek, Terrence Aselford, Scott McCormick, Michael Glenn, Christopher Sheeran, Thomas Penny, Ken Jackson, Eric Messner, Christopher Graybill, Johan Detweiler, and Michael John Casey. The Warlords of Nin, Part 1.
Quentin stood at the high parapet, overlooking the tranquil forest. His eyes scanned the gently lifting hills, clothed in their greens of early summer, all softened in the golden afternoon light by the gathering mists of evening. At his hand upon the cool stone balustrade, a thin parchment roll fluttered in the easy breeze. At his feet lay a leather case, from which he had drawn the scroll to read only moments before. The case bore the royal insignia he knew so well, the terrible twisting red dragon of the Dragon King. The warmth of a later afternoon sun splashed full on his face, and yet Quentin felt a chill creeping through him. He hung his head, shaking it slowly from side to side. He turned to see Tolly gliding up. The tall young man settled himself easily on the edge of the parapet and crossed his arms over his chest. He regarded Quentin with a quizzical brown eye.
Listen, it is the sound of the earth at peace. They told me a rider from Ascalon had arrived with a message for you. I thought to come and see if my master required anything.
Quentin looked at his friend and smiled.
You mean curiosity moved you from your beloved stables? Yes, a message from the king.
Quentin picked up the parchment and handed it to Tolly, who began to read. Presently, Tolly's head came up, and his eyes found Quentin studying him.
This does not say what the trouble is.
No, but it is not a request for a friendly visit. There is some need behind it, some urgency. If it were but a small thing, Escavar would have waited. We are due to travel back to Ascalon in a few weeks anyway.
And this recommends that we leave right away. Yes, I see. But there is something else.
What makes you say that?
Only that I know my Kenta very well. You would not look so if you had not a suspicion of what lay behind this innocent summons.
Innocent? But you're right, Tolly. I am afraid a little. Something came over me as I read that message. A feeling of deep sadness, of loss. I'm afraid that if we go to Ascalon now, we will never come back to Dekra again.
You saw this?
Quentin only shook his head.
Well, then it may not be. Your feelings may only be warning of what may come if we do not go at once.
Yes, perhaps you're right. As usual, the servant has rescued his master from himself.
We can leave tonight. It will be good to sleep on the trail again. We have not done that in a long time, you and I.
We shall, but not tonight. Have you forgotten that tonight we dine with Yesif? If I'm not mistaken, we have only enough time to prepare ourselves and go to his house. He'll be waiting. We will leave at dawn instead.
So be it. I will see to our preparations when we have supped with Yesif and the elders.
The two dressed themselves in their finest woolen mantles and stuffed their feet into fine leather boots and set off for Yesif's humble lodgings. Yesif lived in a quarter of the mined city near the library. As they walked along together, Quentin looked upon the home he had come to love. His eyes, long ago accustomed to the tumbled structures that still met his gaze on every side, seemed not to notice the destruction, but instead saw it all the way it had been in the time of the mighty Araga. In his mind, he saw stones lifted back into place one upon another, arches reconstructed with their colorful tiles, and beautifully carved doors thrown wide in welcome, courtyards once again abloom with flowering plants. He saw it all as he imagined it had been. Quentin always experienced the same magical sensation when he moved about the city. In the 10 years he had lived in Dekra, he never lost the rapture it held for him, or the feeling that he belonged there. But Dekra was his home, as was none other he would ever find.
It will be once again.
What will be?
This city. It will be again what it once was, the way you see it in your head.
Do you think so?
Don't you?
I believe that it will. I want to believe. Though it seems sometimes that the work goes very slowly. There is so much to be done. We could use more hands.
But look how much has been accomplished since we came here. And every year our numbers grow. Wist Orin blesses our efforts with his own.
It was true. The work of restoring the ancient city and populating it with people who shared the dream of rebuilding it to its former glory, of studying the ways of the Araga and their god, was going on at a fine pace. Much had been done in 10 years' time. The work of a lifetime, however, still remained. And that was what pricked Quentin's impatience. They met Quentin's stooped, old teacher where he stood waiting for them at the gate of his courtyard. His face beamed when he saw the two young men striding up.
Hello! Hello, my friends. I've been waiting for you. You are the first to arrive. I was hoping that would be the case. I wanted to talk to you both.
Yesef drew them into the shady courtyard and led them to stone benches under a spreading tree. The yard was spotless and furnished as nicely as any garden could be whose owner loved plants and flowering things.
Sit down, please. Sit. Omani!
A slim young girl appeared with a tray of wooden goblets and a stone carafe. She floated forward with an easy grace and laid the tray at Yesef's elbow where he sat.
You may pour, Bright One.
The girl poured and served the beverages around. She turned to leave.
See that the meal is prepared when the others arrive. It will not be long now, I think.
The servant girl bowed and retreated into the house, smiling all the while. The Kuratok did not have servants, but often young girls or boys would attach themselves to the households of older Kuratok leaders or craftsmen to serve and learn at their hand, until they decided what they wished to do with their lives. In that way, those who needed the assistance of a servant did not lack, and young people found useful occupation until they could enter the adult world. Yesef watched the girl disappear into his darkened doorway, a little wistfully. Quentin noticed his look.
She's a very able helper, Yesef. You are blessed.
Yes. And I am sorry to lose her.
Why would you lose her?
Why not? She is nearly 18. She wishes to be married soon. Next summer, perhaps. She and Rulan, a former pupil of mine. He's a good young man, very intelligent. It will be a good match. But I will lose a wonderful cook and companion. I feel she is my own daughter.
Why don't you get married again?
Yesef suddenly looked flustered.
Who has been talking to you?
No one. I merely wondered.
Well, it is true, nonetheless. That is what I wanted to tell you. I am to be married. I'm announcing the banns tonight.
Congratulations. Who is the lucky bride?
It is Carol, the cloth maker.
The widow of Lendo, who was killed in the accident at the forge some years ago.
Yes, the same. A fine woman. She has been lonely for so long.
You need not explain to us. You have our permission already. I'm sure you will both be very happy together.
Yes, we shall. I am very happy now sharing this news with my friends. You know, I have come to regard you both as my own sons.
Certainly. You have been both teacher and father to us more times than we can remember.
So it is fitting that you are the first to know.
Will the honored woman be here tonight? I would wish to congratulate her as well.
She will be here if that is not her voice I hear even now.
Yesef dashed to the gate once more and welcomed his bride and her two companions. Blushing and smiling, he led her toward Quentin and Toli, who stood grinning.
My friends, this is my betrothed, Carol.
The short, round-faced woman smiled warmly back at them. Her hair was bound demurely at her neck in an ornamented netting, and among the brown, Quentin could see streaks of silver. She was dressed in a plain white, loose-fitting gown with a bright blue shawl over her shoulders. She was a handsome woman. As Yesef drew her close to him with his arm, he gave his future wife a look of such endearment that Quentin felt a pang of longing for his own beloved.
Hello, Carol, and congratulations. Yesef has been telling us that you two are to be married. I'm very pleased.
Oh, thank you, Quentin. We are very happy. Yesef is full of your praises. It pleases me that he has chosen you to hear of our plans first.
When will the wedding take place?
Yesef and I thought that a midsummer wedding would be nice.
Yes. There is really nothing to prevent us being married at once. We are both of age. Oh.
The laughter faded when Yesef saw that neither Quentin nor Toli shared their mirth. Both had become strangely silent. The light of happiness was extinguished in their eyes.
What is the matter? Does our plan not meet with your approval?
Yes, and more than you know. But I fear that I will not be among the happy wedding guests.
Why not, may I ask?
We were going to tell you this evening. We have received a summons from the king, and we must leave for Ascalon.
Yes, I know, in a few weeks, but...
No, at once. A rider came today. We must leave at once.
Then we will wait until you return.
Carol nodded her agreement.
No, I could not ask that. I do not know when we may return. Please, do not wait on our account.
Kenta means that if he were in your place, Yesef, he would not let so lovely a creature escape into the arms of another. You must marry as you have planned. We will return to greet the happy couple before they have been wed a fortnight.
Yesef sought Quentin's eyes. As usual, he could read more there than his friend intended.
Is it trouble, then?
I fear that it is. The message did not say it directly, and the courier did not say more. But he left immediately, without awaiting an answer.
Yesef regarded Quentin as he stood before him. From an awkward, impetuous youth had grown a square-shouldered, sensitive man. Tall, lean in the way young men are, yet without the careless air they often have. Quentin had a regal bearing, and yet utterly lacked any self-consciousness of it, or the arrogance that often accompanied such a noble spirit. A pang of longing ached in the old man's heart when he saw his young pupil and protege wavering, as if on the brink of a great abyss. He wanted to reach out and pull him back, but he knew he could not. Quentin belonged to Dekra, yes, but he also belonged to Ascalon, and neither loyalty could he deny.
You must go, of course. When will you leave?
Tomorrow, at dawn. I think it best.
Of course, of course. Do not delay. Besides, the sooner you are off, the sooner you may return. And perhaps you will bring Bria with you this time.
At the mention of the name, Quentin started. He smiled warmly again. The cold shadow which had fallen upon the happy group moved away, and in the glimmering of a softly falling twilight, they began to talk excitedly once more of all they would do when next they met. Despite their desire for an early start the next morning, Quentin and Toli were the last to leave Yesef's house. There had been much singing and eating and talking. The elders had blessed the young men's journey, and all had listened to stories and songs of the lost Araga, sung by one of the young Kuratok musicians. Then all had made their goodbyes, but none more ardently than did Quentin.
Look, Kenta.
Toli spoke as they found their way along the dark and empty streets. The moon shone full upon the city, pouring out a liquid silver light along all it touched. Quentin followed Toli's gaze upward toward the sky.
What do you see?
It is gone now. A star fell, that is all.
Quentin listened to their footsteps and felt Dekra's quiet peacefulness enfold him. Then, unaccountably, he felt a chill, as if they had just walked through a hanging pool of cooler air. Toli noticed the quiver of Quentin's shoulders and looked at his friend.
Did you feel it too?
Quentin ignored the question, and they continued on for a few more paces.
Do you think we will ever return to this place?
The night is not a time to dwell on such things.
The two walked silently back to the governor's palace and made their way to their rooms.
It will be good to see Ascalon again and all our friends. Good night.
Good night. I will wake you in the morning.
Quentin met Toli in the stables, the grouping of low stone structures that Toli had turned to the purpose of breeding horses. In his time at Dekra, the Jer had become an excellent trainer and breeder of fine horses. In fact, with the help of Escobar's stable master, he was developing a remarkable strain of animals, which were a cross between the heavier war horses, such as Balder, and lighter, more fleet racing stock, which were the pride of Pelagia. The resulting breed would possess strength and stamina enough for battle, but would also have the ability to run fast and far without tiring. Quentin passed under the wide stone arch and came to stand before Baldur's stall. He held out his hand and patted the horse's soft muzzle and stroked the bulging jaw.
You may stay here this time, old boy. Take care of him, Wilton. Give him an extra carrot now and then. We'll go for a long ride when I come back.
The stable smelled of sweet fennel and straw and the warm bodies of the horses. The smell reminded Quentin of traveling, and he reflected that he was indeed anxious to be off. He crossed to where Tolly stood, checking their mount's tack and gear.
Good morning, Kenta. I was just about to come and wake you.
As you see, I'm ready to go. I did not sleep much of the night. It's all prepared.
Quentin turned to slap a milk-white stallion on the shoulder.
Oh there, Blazer. Are you anxious to stretch those long legs of yours?
I have only to charge Wilton with some final instructions. Then we shall go.
It amused Quentin that Tolly, who considered himself Quentin's servant for life, was also an object of devotion among the Kuratok. The gentle Jair enjoyed the services of several helpers, whom he treated as well as any master treated a devoted servant. The simple fact was that Tolly was regarded as much a prince as was Quentin, and in the city, where all men were servants of one another, this was the highest honor. Tolly returned and took the reins of both horses and led them out into the quiet streets. Quentin followed at Tolly's right hand. In the east, the sky shone with a violet haze, which lightened into a golden red hue as the sun rose higher.
The wind is from the west over the sea. We will have good weather for our journey.
Good. I am hoping to be in Ascalon before the new moon. We should be able to manage that, eh?
It is possible. With good horses and the King's Road restored through Peldrin.
We have horses with wings, my friend. And Escavar's road is now complete as far as the Arvin. We shall fly indeed.
They reached the gates of the city and let themselves out. The gates were seldom tended, since Dekra had no fear of intrusion and no real need of defense. At the small door, which opened within the larger, Quentin paused and took a long last look upon the city he loved. The red stone glowed with the rosy hue of the rising sun. Towers and spires swept majestically into the clear, cool morning air, gleaming and glittering like radiant crystal. Behind him, Blazer and Riv, Tolly's sleek black mount, shook their bridles, impatient to be moving along. Quentin raised an arm in farewell to Dekra, and then turned to his horse.
It's time for speed. On, Blazer!
Quentin pushed an eager course through the low hills and into the wretched marshlands. They planned to hold north as far as Malmarby, thus skirting the boggy wasteland as much as possible. At Malmarby, they would hire a boat to cross the inlet and swing along the shore west past Sobercor's wall. Then the trail would become easier. They would make for the Arvin River, where it came spilling clear and cold out of the Fiskills, and ride through the wild foothills above Narramore along the King's New Road, and speed along through Pelgrin to Ascalon. The days on the trail were uneventful. Game was plentiful, and thanks to Tolly's skill as a hunter, they never lacked for anything the hills could provide. They arrived at Malmarby village one bright morning, picking the wider path toward the town, out of a maze of bogs and wetlands that surrounded it. As they approached the village, Tolly stiffened in the saddle and reined his horse to a halt. Quentin mirrored his actions, wondering what had alarmed his friend.
What is it? What do you see?
Something is amiss in the village yonder. I feel it.
It looks peaceful enough, but let us go with caution.
They paced the horses slowly ahead, and both watched the thickets and dense shrubbery which lined the path for any signal that might confirm Tolly's apprehension. They saw no one and heard nothing until just before reaching the village itself. Quentin stopped his horse and stood in the saddle, looking around. The muddy track, which served as Malmarby's main street, was vacant. No living thing stirred among the rough wooden houses. The town lay silent as a tomb.
There does not appear to be anyone around. I wonder where...
He had not finished speaking when four men sprang out of the nearest thicket and grabbed the horses' bridles. Two of the men were armed with spears and the others with short swords. All appeared very frightened, their faces grim with worry and pale from fear. It was the look upon these sorry faces which made Quentin hold his hand.
Stay, Tolly! We need not fear these men, I think.
There was a rustle in the thicket, and another man stepped out, or rather fell, into the road. Quentin recognized the thin, careworn face of the village counselor.
Good morning, counselor. Is this the way you treat strangers nowadays? Or perhaps you wish to invite us to breakfast?
The thin, bald man blinked and rushed forward, squinting at the travelers with his one good eye.
Quentin? Step back, men. It is the prince. Let them go.
Quentin smiled at the appellation. He was not the prince, but his legend had so grown among the simple people of Mensendor that he held that lofty position in their esteem. So they conferred upon him the highest title they could presume. To them, he was quite simply the prince.
I'm sorry, good sir. We meant you no harm.
The village chief looked heartbroken. He wrung his hands as he spoke, as if he feared some fierce retribution.
It's just that, well, we cannot be too careful these days. There have been stories of evil deeds. We thought it best to post a watch in the road.
Robbers?
You yourself have seen nothing.
No, nothing.
Quentin shrugged and looked at Tolly. Tolly studied the faces of the men before them and remained silent.
Well, perhaps our fears are unfounded. Will you stay with us?
No, not this time. If we may have the use of one of your excellent boats, we will put off directly. We are going to Ascalon as quickly as may be.
The town councillor fixed Quentin with a strange, knowing look and turned away.
Go on ahead and tell the town. The way is clear. There is nothing to fear.
Mylin turned back to Quentin.
The boat is yours. You may take mine. It is the largest by far. My son will go with you.
We are grateful for your kindness.
They passed the simple dwellings, which crowded one another all along the path, right down to the water's edge. Quentin saw an occasional fleeting face at a window or peering from a doorway. But by the time they reached the great wooden pier, which served as wharf for the town's fishing boats, most of Malmarby's citizens were going about their business as though nothing unusual had happened. Many followed them down to the pier, and many more hailed the regal travelers as they passed. The boats of Malmarby were broad, boxy things, sturdy enough to withstand the anger of the harshest seas, which they never faced, since the bulky boat served but to ply the sheltered inlet from one end to the other along its length. Mylan's boat was more than adequate for their need, though the horses showed some trepidation at being led aboard such a strange-looking vessel. With Mylan's son Rol at the long stern oar, they waved themselves away from the throng on the pier. Rol's strong hands worked the oar, and soon they had entered a deeper channel where a swift current pulled them along. They raised the small sail on its stubby mast and drifted smartly away.
Where do you wish to land, my lords?
Anywhere you think best, as long as it is west of the wall.
Quentin paused and regarded the hardy youth with his strong shoulders and thick thatch of brown hair. He remembered when the good-natured young man had been a skinny little boy who ran alongside the horses whenever a traveler passed through the village, such as Quentin and Tolly often had occasion to do.
What is it the village fears? What has come to pass since we have last come this way?
Rol shrugged a muscled shoulder and continued working the oar.
I don't know. Stories, that is all. It does not take much to frighten such a small village.
What are these stories you speak of? And where do they come from?
Tolly stepped in to hear what Rol had to say.
Oh, this spring some people came up to us out of the South Lane saying that they had been set upon by demons and their homes burned.
Demons do not burn homes.
Well, I don't know if I do or no. That's just what the people said.
That is strange. Did they say what these demons looked like?
Oh, they were giants. Fierce. You know, fire spewed from their mouths, and each of them had 10 arms with claws for hands.
Where did these demons come from? Did they say?
No one knew. Some said they came from beyond the sea, from beyond a Gephalon. Others said they saw the sign of the wolf star on the forehead. Maybe they came down from the sky.
This is an odd tale.
Quentin drew Tolly aside.
Why would anyone burn a village of peasants in the Southlands? There is little enough there, and nothing to be gained by such doings.
I cannot guess. There has been nothing like this these past 10 years. The realm is at peace. We must remember to tell the king about what we have heard.
Rol proved an able seaman, and the day's end found them close to their destination. A faint mist gathered on the water at the shoreline and pushed out into the inlet. Through the gray mist, they saw the dark plain of the great wall jutting out into the deep water as the shadows lengthened upon the land. Rol steered the boat around the wall's looming edge and made for the rocky strand. No one spoke as they passed by the imposing shape. Quentin watched the mist curling around the base of the wall and thought it made the wall appear to be floating on a foundation of billowing clouds, while the deepening sky above seemed to grow hard and solid as stone as it darkened with the twilight. Roll brought the boat to shore.
Will you stay with us tonight, Roll? We will camp a little way along the trail up there.
Quentin pointed to a tree-lined rise which bordered the shore.
Tolly will have the fire going in no time, and we'll have some hot food.
Thank you, my lord. I'm tired and hungry too. I can't say which I am more.
Well, you have done us a great service, and it shall be rewarded. Here.
Quentin reached into the soft leather pouch which hung at his belt.
A gold ducat for your trouble, and one for your kindness.
Roll bowed low as he thrust out his calloused hand.
Oh, sir, this is too much. I durst not accept so much.
Roll fingered the gold coins and handed them back to Quentin.
No, you have earned them both, and our praise besides. Keep them and say no more about it. But look, Tolly is already making camp. Let us hurry to join him, or we may be too late for our supper.
The three reclined around the fire and talked as the stars came out in the immense black vault of the heavens. Tall pines stood over them, and the air smelled of fresh wind and balsam. Quentin drifted easily to sleep, nodding in his place, until he at last bade his companions good night and rolled himself in his cloak. Tolly added another log to the fire and got up to check the horses before he himself turned in. Roll already slept soundly. Tolly stretched and lifted his eyes to the night sky, now sparkling with tiny lights. As he scanned the heavens, his eye caught a curious sight. He stood for a moment, contemplating what he saw, and then he turned and crept softly toward Quentin.
Kenta, I want you to see something.
Quentin turned and sat up. He peered intently into Tolly's face, lit on one side by the firelight. He could not read the expression there.
What is it? Have you seen the last white stack?
No, nothing so important. I thought you might want to see this.
Tolly led Quentin a short space away from the fire and the overhanging boughs of the trees.
Look to the east. There, just above the wall. Do you see it?
A star? Yes, I see it, that very bright star.
See how it shines. Do you think it odd?
It is the wolf star. But you're right. It does have a different look tonight. What do you make of it?
Tolly gazed upward at the brilliant star, and at last turned away.
I do not know what to make of it. I only wanted you to see it, so that we may be agreed about it.
Quentin was not satisfied with this answer. Tolly, evidently withholding something, declined to speak further. There was no use in pushing the matter until the Jair was ready to say more. Whatever was tumbling around in that head would come out sooner or later, but only when Tolly desired it so. Quentin would wait. He rolled himself once more in his cloak and fell to sleep. Blazer and Riv picked their way among the loose stones of the canyon floor as Quentin and Tolly scanned the soaring cliffs above. All around them towered jagged spires of rock. They moved carefully, as through a giant's petrified forest. They passed between two large outcroppings of dull brown stone, upon which rested a great slab, forming the posts and lintel of an enormous doorway.
Azrael Gate.
They passed quickly through the opening.
Look, Escavaz Road.
Quentin pointed across Arvin's racing headwaters to the other side, where the road began. Without hesitation, Quentin urged his steed forward into the frigid water. The swift stream splashed around the horse's legs and wet his rider to the knees. Quentin found the icy tingle the perfect tonic to banish the oppressive foreboding which had settled upon him, as it always did when he rode through the eerie canyon which ended in Azrael's Gate. Now, with that behind and the clear, wide road ahead, his spirit suddenly lifted.
It won't be long now.
Tolly was just splashing into the course.
Tomorrow night we will dine with Derwin, and the following will see us at the Dragon King's table.
I thought you were the one for haste. We can do better than that.
A challenge! Yeah!
Their chase brought the pair over and through the rolling hills and lifted both their spirits immensely. At last, exhausted, the two trotted to a halt upon a ridge. Below them, the foothills dropped away in gentle arcs, fading from violet to blue in the hazy distance. Away to the south stood the lofty snow-wrapped crags of the Fiskills, where endless winds howled among the sharp peaks.
Ah, such a sight. It is a beautiful land, is it not?
It is that and more, indeed. My people have a word for the land. I do not think I have ever told you. Al-Alira.
Oh, I've never heard it. What does it mean?
I cannot be precise. There is no exact meaning in your tongue. But it means something like the land of flowing peace.
Al-Alira. I like that. It fits.
They started down together.
And it certainly is peaceful. Look out across those valleys. These years have been good ones. The land has produced full measure. The people are content. I cannot think but that the god has blessed the realm in recompense for the troubled times when Escavar was away from his throne.
Yes, these have been good years. Golden times. I hope we will see them endure.
Quentin cast a sideways glance at his companion. Tolly's eyes were focused on some distant horizon. He appeared as if in a trance. Quentin did not want to break the happy mood, so did not pursue the matter further. They continued down the slope without speaking. The road made going easy, and they pushed a steady pace, reaching the lowlands by midday.
Along the road yonder, we have some company.
Quentin raised his eyes and saw very faintly and very far away what appeared to be a group of travelers coming toward them on foot. It was just a glimpse, and then a bend in the road took them from Quentin's sight.
Merchants, perhaps?
Often traders who sold their wares from town to town banded together in traveling companies for mutual entertainment and protection.
I would buy a trinket for Bria.
They continued on, and Quentin thought of all the things his lovely would enjoy. They rounded the side of a grassy hill covered with scarlet wildflowers and approached the spot where they had first seen the travelers.
Odd. We should have met them by now. Perhaps they stopped up the road beyond that dump of trees.
Quentin pointed ahead to where a bushy stand of trees overhung the road, sheltering all beyond from view. They continued on with a growing perplexity. When they reached the shelter of the trees, they could look once again far down the road. There was not a single person to be seen.
This becomes stranger with every step.
Tolly swung himself down from his horse and walked along the road, his eyes searching the dust for any signs which might hold an explanation of the disappearance of the group they had both seen quite clearly only a short while before. They moved forward slowly. Quentin watched the wooded area to the right of the road. Then Tolly stopped and knelt down. He traced his finger around the outline of footprints in the dust.
They stopped here before leaving the road. There.
He pointed into the trees.
How many were there?
I cannot say from these signs, but there were men and women, children too.
Huh. I wonder what has sent them scurrying into the woods. Not the sight of two horsemen, surely.
Tolly shrugged and climbed back into the saddle.
Here is something else we must remember to tell the king.
Indeed we will.
At dusk, they camped in a grassy glade just off the road. The sun sent ruby fingers sifting through the gossamer clouds, which moved gracefully across the violet arc of heaven. Quentin stood in a meadow dotted with yellow flowers that brushed pollen-laden beads against his legs. With his arms crossed on his chest and a look of dreamy concentration, he contemplated the imposing shape before him. High up on its plateau, the thin trail leading up like a white wisp rising from the lower ground, stood the high temple of Ariel.
You miss your old home, no doubt.
No. No more than one misses the shadow once he walks in the sunshine. I was only thinking of the time I spent in that temple, for the days of loneliness and frustration, of endless studying and not finding the one I really sought. I would not have made a very good priest. I could never see the sense in anointing the sacred rock of the temple. It seemed like such a waste of expensive oil, though others esteemed it a fine gift. And the sacrifices, the gold bracelets, silver bowls, and carefully groomed animals simply made the priests wealthier and fatter than they already were. Wisdoran demands more than bracelets, bowls, or flesh. And he lives not only in temples made by men, but in their lives. Yes, the God Most High holds out freedom to men. The price is unbending devotion. The lesser gods do not demand as much, but who can know them? They are like the mists on the water. When the sun touches them, they vanish.
They turned and went back to settle themselves for the night. They ate, and Tolly turned the horses out to graze in the sweet grass, as evening gathered its long purple robes about the quiet glade. Quentin lay with his head resting upon his saddle, with a clear, unhindered view of the spangled heavens.
The stars never change.
And then, Quentin remembered the conversation he had earlier with Tolly. He turned his head toward the east and saw the strangely glittering star Tully had pointed out to him several nights before.
The wolf star seems to grow brighter.
I have been thinking the same thing, Kenta.
I wonder what High Priest Bjorkus would say to an omen such as this. The priests surely have their explanations.
Go and ask him.
What? Do you think I dare?
Why not? There is no harm.
I do not believe my ears. My servant tells me to seek an omen from an unholy source. You, Tully, of all people, know I have turned away from tokens and omens. I follow a different god. We both do.
I do not suggest you ask an omen of Ariel, or discard truths you have learned. Only that you go to your one-time friend and ask his opinion of a strange event. There is no harm in that. Besides, Wist Orin, who holds the stars in their courses, sometimes declares his will through such portents. Any who will look may see what is written there.
You're right, Tully. Bjorkus is still my friend. Besides, I would like to take a walk. Come along.
Quentin was on his feet and striding off across the meadow toward the temple trail, which showed in the bright moonlight as a silver thread winding its way up the side of the steep hill. They reached the trail and began the circuitous ascent to the top. As they climbed higher, Quentin looked out into the moon-bright night. The valley glimmered darkly. Every leaf of tree and blade of grass was traced in spun silver. Away in the distant hills, shepherd's fires winked like stars fallen upon the land. They gained the top at last and entered the expansive courtyard. In the center of the white, stone-paved yard stood a torch on a carven stone stanchion. Its fluttering flame cast a wide circle of light around its base and reflected on the closed doors of the temple.
We will see if pilgrims such as we are made welcome by night.
They crossed the courtyard and climbed the many steps to the main entrance. Upon reaching the huge doors, Quentin lifted his poniard from its sheath at his belt and rapped upon the solid beams with its handle. He waited, knowing at this late hour he must rouse some nearby priest from his sleep. As he waited, an uncanny sensation came over Quentin, a feeling that he was once more the skinny temple acolyte of so many years ago. For a moment, he looked at the dark stone of the temple and the moonlight-filled courtyard through the eyes of his youth.
Be on your way, pilgrim, and come back tomorrow. The priests are asleep.
There is one who will admit us if you but tell him who it is who desires entry.
There is none who would admit you but the high priest himself.
Excellent. He is the very man we seek.
No, go away. Come back tomorrow. I'll not disturb him tonight.
Well, he means to do us no favors. But there is another entrance at the rear of the temple. We will try that, having come this far.
The two moved like shadows under the high portico of the temple and reached the far south side, that which overlooked the peaceful valley. They walked along the side of the temple, the moonlight falling in slanting rays, forming bands of light and shadow under the mighty eaves.
Listen, voices.
Quentin paused and cocked his head to one side. Voices from a little way ahead and below them carried on the still air. They continued more cautiously. Soon the travelers were crouching behind the immense columns of the temple, looking down upon a small circle of robed men bent over a shining object.
They're star searching. And look, that one in the center. I think I know that shape.
Quentin stepped boldly out of the shadow of the column and descended a few steps toward the group.
Priests of Ariel, will you receive two curious pilgrims?
The priest in the center of the huddle stepped forward.
Pilgrims are always welcome to the Shrine of Ariel, though most choose to make oblations in the light of day.
We do not come to make oblations or to inquire of the god Ariel, but of a priest instead.
Priests are but the servants of their god. It is he who declares his will.
Neither do we ask for the god's interest in any affairs of ours.
Quentin could see the man's face, full in the moonlight now, and knew that he addressed his old tutor.
We would speak to you man to man.
Quentin smiled as a faint glimmer of recognition lit the priest's visage.
My heart tells me that I should know you, sir.
The old eyes searched the young man's features for a clue which might tell him who it was that addressed him.
But a name does not come to my lips. Have we met, then?
Quentin moved closer and placed his hands on the priest's rounded shoulders.
Is the life of a priest so busy that he has no time for memories?
Memories do not walk the temple yards by night, nor do they confront their bearers face to face.
Then perhaps you will remember this.
Quentin dug into the pouch at his belt and produced a silver coin. He handed it to the priest.
This is a temple coin. Then you must be...
You gave me that coin yourself, Bjorkus, many years ago.
But, Quentin? Is this Quentin the Acolyte?
Yes. I have returned to see you, my old friend, for so I always considered you.
But how you have changed. You have grown up a fine man. You are well, as I can see. What brings you here tonight of all nights?
The other priests looked upon this reunion in wonder. They gathered close around to see who this returned stranger might be.
Can we walk a little aside? I have something to ask you.
The two moved on, followed closely by Tolly.
Your name has grown in the land.
They walked to a rocky outcropping at the edge of the plateau.
Oh? You hear tales up here, do you?
We hear what we wish to hear. The peasants bring us no end of information. Some of it is useful. But you are known as the prince who saved the Dragon King and defeated the monstrous sorcerer Nimrod.
It was not I who defeated Nimrod, but Tolly here, my servant and friend.
Bjorkus bowed to Tolly and indicated that they should all seat themselves upon the rocks.
They also say that you are building a city in the wilderness which rises by magic from the stones of the earth.
Again, that is not my doing. Dekra is my city only in that the gracious Kuratok have allowed me to join in their work of restoring it to its former glory.
This is what the people say, not I. As for myself, I surmise that the truth of these stories is to be found at the heart like the stone of an apricot. But I know from this that my former acolyte is doing well and has risen in the esteem of his countrymen. But why should you seek me out now? The temple doors have not been closed these many years.
We've come to ask your opinion of something we have seen.
Quentin turned toward the east and pointed out across the quiet, moon-filled valley.
That star rising yonder, the Wolf Star, has it not changed in some way of late? Do the priests detect a waxing of its power?
So, you have not forsaken your studies altogether. You still seek signs in the night sky.
No, I must admit, I no longer study the stars and their courses. This event was pointed out to me by Tolly, who remarked on it a few nights ago.
Well, your Tolly is right. In fact, we have been following this star with interest for many months. Tonight, as you have seen, we were once more examining the charts and seeking an answer to this wonder.
Then you do not know what this sign portends.
Does one ever? Why do you look so shocked? The priest may have doubts, even the high priest. Ah, but we have our theories. Yes, many theories.
That is what we have come to hear, your theories. What do you think it means?
Derwin's long brown robe swept along behind him as he rushed along the darkened corridors of Ascalon Castle. Torches lit the way, sputtering in the gusty air as Derwin hurriedly passed. Ahead of him, he could see a pair of doors which opened onto a patch of the night sky, infused with the moon's radiant beams. He stepped across the threshold and onto the balcony, then paused. There, a few paces from him, stood the slim figure of a woman. Her dark hair tumbled down in shimmering ringlets and curls, and her face was averted, revealing the shapely beauty of her slender neck. She was dressed in a loose-fitting gown of white, held at her trim waist by a long blue sash which trailed nearly to the ground.
Your Majesty, I am here.
The woman turned and smiled.
Good, Derwin, thank you for coming so quickly.
Rhea, I thought...
You thought I was the queen, I know, but it was I who sent you this summons.
You look so much like your mother standing there with the moonlight in your hair.
I will accept that as a compliment, kind sir. For me, there is none higher. But you must be tired from your journey. I will not keep you, but I must speak to you a little. Do sit down, please.
Bria raised her arm and indicated a stone bench a short space away. Derwin took her arm and walked with her along the balcony.
The night is beautiful, is it not?
Yes, it is very.
The hermit could tell she had something on her mind which disturbed her.
I would not have troubled you, but I could think of no better help than to have you here. Thedo is gone, and Ronsard is with him.
It is nothing, my lady. I am only too glad to know that this old hermit may still be of some use to those who dwell in Castle Ascalon. I would have come sooner if I had known. Your courier had quite a time finding me. I was in the forest gathering herbs and tending to the illness of a peasant's wife nearby.
I knew you would come as soon as you could.
What is the matter, Bria? You may speak freely. I am your friend.
Oh, Derwin.
Bria's hands trembled, and her head sank. She buried her face in her hands, and he thought she would cry. But she raised her face to the moon, clear-eyed. In that moment, the young woman reminded him more than ever of another woman who bore an immense inner strength in times of great distress, Queen Alenia.
It is the king. Oh, Derwin, I am very worried. He is not like himself. I think he is very ill, but he will see none of his doctors. He laughs at any suggestion I make regarding his health. My mother is worried, too, but she can do nothing either. And there is something else.
Derwin waited patiently.
I do not know what it is. Trouble, I think. Somewhere.
Bria turned and fixed the hermit with a smile, which, though it graced her mouth, did not light her eyes as it normally would.
Quentin is coming.
Yes, I know. In a few weeks, we are all going to celebrate Midsummer's Day together.
No, he is coming now. Escavar sent for him. Even knowing that he would come for Midsummer, the king sent a special courier to bring him. That is how I know there is something wrong.
It could just be that he wishes to see him the sooner. Just a whim, that's all.
Thank you for that. But you know the Dragon King as well as I do. He does nothing on a whim. He has some reason for wanting him here. But what it is, I cannot guess.
Then we will wait and see. When will Quentin be here?
If he left upon receiving the summons, I believe he would be here the day after tomorrow. The day after that, at the latest.
Good. That is not so long to wait. You will see. In the meantime, I will try to discover what ails the king in body or in spirit. Anything that may be done, I will do. Worry no more on it, my lady.
Thank you, fair friend. You will not tell them I sent for you?
No, if you would rather not. I will just say that I grew weary of my books and medicines and desired the warmth of fellowship with my friends. I came early to the celebration, that is all.
I feel better already knowing you are here.
I'm content. Though I imagine you would rather a certain younger man stood here right now.
Bria smiled, and this time the light sparkled in her deep green eyes.
Oh, I'll not deny it, but I am content to wait. It does cheer me somehow to know that he comes the sooner.
They talked some more and then rose. Bria bade Derwin a good night. Derwin escorted her to the door back into the castle, and then turned to stroll along the balcony alone. He leaned his arms on the parapet and looked into the gardens below. In the moonlight, he saw a solitary figure pacing among the beds of ruby roses, now indigo in the moonlight. He could not see who this person might be, but it was clear from the altered gait that the walker had fallen prey to a melancholy mood. He hunched forward and crossed his arms on his chest, stopped and started continually. Derwin looked on, and then the figure seemed to sense that he was being watched. He stopped and drew himself up and turned to look quickly into the balcony. Derwin drew away, but he had seen what he had already guessed. In the moment the face swung around, the moonlight illumined it, and Derwin knew that it was Escavar, the Dragon King. Bjorkus' long white braided beard, the symbol of his office, glowed like a bright waterfall frozen in the moonlight. His wrinkled face, though still as round and plump as ever, looked itself a smaller moon, returning its reflected light to a larger parent. He gazed long into the sky.
It may be something, or it may not. The heavens are filled with signs and wonders, and not all of them have to do with men.
If you thought that, would you be standing out in the night stargazing?
No, likely not. But this is a most peculiar phenomenon. One does not see such a sign but once in a lifetime, perhaps not even then. To chart its progress would be of value aside from any meaning we might derive from its study.
You evade my questions, Bjorkus. Why? Certainly the star is there for all to see and make what they will of it.
To the best of my knowledge, this star is an evil sign.
The effect produced within Quentin chilled his blood. He fancied the air had grown suddenly colder.
Omens are always either good or bad, depending upon the reader.
Ah, but the greater the sign, the greater the consequence. This is a great sign indeed, surpassingly great.
Quentin raised his eyes to the eastern sky and regarded the star carefully. It was bright, yes, but there were other stars nearly as bright. He looked back at Bjorkus with a questioning glance.
It has only begun to show itself. With every passing night it grows brighter, and so does the evil it portends.
What is the nature of this evil? Can you tell?
Evil is evil, you know that. What does it matter? The suffering will be great in any case. Flood, famine, pestilence, war are all the same. All destroy in their turn.
Well said. Your words are true. But men may do much to prepare against an evil time, if they but know its source.
Here is where our theories guide us. Some say that the star will grow and grow until it fills the sky, blotting out the sun and moon and stars. Then it will touch the earth and drive all living things insane before consuming them with fire. Others say that each nation has a star, and that this wolf star represents a fierce and brutal nation which rises against other nations and seeks to extinguish them with its power. Still others regard this as the beginning of the end of mankind on the earth. This star is the token of Nin, the destroyer god, who brings his armies down to make war on the nations of the earth.
And you, Bjorkus? What do you say?
I believe all are right. Some part of every guess will be shown in the truth.
When may that truth be evident?
Who can say? Much that is foretold does not come to pass. Our best divinations are only the mumblings of blind men. Nothing is certain. Nothing is certain.
Quentin stood, went to the old priest, and placed a hand on his shoulder.
Old man, come with us. You have lived long enough to see the gods for what they are. Let us show you a god worthy of your devotion. The Most High, Lord of all. In him you will find the peace you seek. You told me once that you sought a brighter light.
You remember that?
Yes, and more. I remember you were my only friend in the temple. Come with us now and let us show you the light you have been seeking for so long.
I am too old to change. Yes, these eyes have searched for the truth, but it has been denied them. I know the hollowness of serving these petty gods. But I am High Priest. I cannot go with you now. Maybe once I could have turned away as Derwin did, as you have, but not now. It is too late for me.
I am sorry.
Tolly had risen and was moving away. Quentin turned and looked back at Bjorkus, who still remained perched upon a rock, looking out into the peaceful valley.
It is not too late. You have only to turn aside and he will meet you. The decision is yours.
Quentin and Tolly walked down the sinuous trail, side by side, without speaking. They reached the meadow and the dimly glowing embers of their fire.
You knew the star to be an evil sign, didn't you?
Yes, I considered it so.
But you suggested we go to the temple. Why?
I wanted to hear what other learned men might say. For all their spiritual uncertainties, the priests are still men of great knowledge.
And did Bjorkus confirm your worst fears?
Bjorkus spoke of what may be, not what will be. Only the God Most High can say what will be. His hand is ever outstretched to those who serve him.
Well, if Bjorkus is right in his speculations, then we will have need of that strong hand before long, I fear.